Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, which I am contractually obliged to mention is your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. My name is George Culkin and I'm joined this week by the wonderful Christopher Waffler. How are you doing, Chris?
I am fine, thank you. Find it a little bit strange hearing you introduce the podcast, but at the same time, I am okay.
Well, this is my moment to shine, Chris. We thought, you know, I've been waiting for my big break, my big moment. Maybe this is, you know, this is my time to shine, to prove I can do this, to show that I can, I deserve my place on the big stage.
And honestly, do you think you've fulfilled that?
No, I think it's already sounding pretty bad, actually. We should say hello and send love to Taylor, who's not able to be with us this week. So we send him lots of love and happy very thoughts. So. And we'll just have to try and crack on and do our best without him, won't we?
Yes, well, you're back this week, George. Well, where were you last week?
Well, I had a bit of time off, which was very nice because I didn't have to have any dealings with you in particular. And today, though, I've just been hanging out in the staff canteen with a certain Big Al, you know, our new work colleague. We've having a good chat about the GGs over a plate of shepherd's pie, and it's poker night tonight, so he's inviting us around. I'm sure you've got your invite to that, have you, Chris?
Well, I think that I'm sort of like B-list reserve. I am a little bit disappointed though because I was under the impression that he was replacing you. So it is you and Big Al together. It's not.
Yes, I'm very much the senior partner in this relationship. No, that's not true at all. But no, I'm really very happy that he's joined us. He's already done a couple of pieces. I'm helping him out with them where I can. So yeah, that first big interview you did with Kenny Dalglish, which was great to listen into and hear those two great fellows talking about all those stories, whether it was Blackburn or Newcastle. Yes, Alan did a piece this week on what it's like to suffer from and recover from an ACL injury, which obviously Virgil van Dijk is going through at the moment after that horrible challenge on him by Jordan Pickford. So that's something that Alan has experience of, sadly, when he was at Blackburn. And he came back as good as ever and went on to have the three best goal-scoring years of his life at Blackburn. So yeah, that's very exciting news. I'm sure he will want to talk about Newcastle at some point as well. So look forward to that. And we don't actually have a staff canteen, do we, sadly? So we're at home. So I made that up to make us sound better than we actually are, which is just two fairly tragic figures recording in our own homes.
Yes, but everyone already knows that, so we can just gloss over that fact. But just on the piece, just the cruciate ligament piece, and obviously it is terrible what's happened to Virgil van Dijk and the fact that Alan Shearer went through, and there's some very interesting details there about how difficult it is coming back. And this probably says a lot more about me than anything, but the bit that struck me most, and it was when he was talking about that he came back and scored his first goal, and he mentions that it's at the Gallagher end, and that just shows, like, only... But obviously he's playing for Blackburn at this stage. The fact that he mentioned that specific detail, I think, says a lot about just how much the club actually meant to him even before he came back. So that sort of struck me a little bit, that I found that stuck out a little bit.
Yeah, typically scoring against us. But yeah, no, I mean, he said, because I sort of said, was there a moment, was there a kind of like a eureka moment when he, or, you know, a moment where he went into a tackle and tested the knee again? And was he worried? Was it that sort of sense? And he said that was actually the moment. So it's sort of quite a nice little story that was the moment, because he had to run in to get onto the ball. So he proved to himself that he could still sprint, and then scoring the goal, he proved to himself he could still finish, he could still kick the ball hard. That was actually the moment when he just finally knew that he was going to be okay. But yeah, slightly typically that it was against Newcastle. Anyway, so we better talk about what's been happening this week and what's going to happen at the weekend, perhaps. So the first, I suppose, most obvious thing to chat about is the fact that Newcastle have now finally submitted their first team squad for the Premier League, as indeed have all other clubs in the division. You've written a piece about that this week. We weren't really given any huge surprises in that list, were we? But there's still a few things that we should talk about.
Yeah, it wasn't really overly surprising. I have written a piece which is available on The Athletic at the minute. There is still a £1 a month offer for the pod listeners at the moment. So if you visit theathletic.com/NewcastlePod, that's theathletic.com/NewcastlePod, you can take advantage of that and go and read it. But essentially, the points that I was looking at within it is, where are they still short? And I still think that the obvious one is up front. Without Wilson, they really look very, very short of firepower. There was a bit of a worrying moment during the Manchester United game where he did pull up and did look like he was in trouble, and there was a few worried glances from the bench, but he was able to carry on. But if Wilson gets injured, then you really worry about them up front. What was interesting was one of the main talking points, one of the main debating issues that I know was spoken about behind the scenes was whether Dwight Gayle should be included in the squad, because obviously last season when Paul Dummett was injured and when Jethro Willems got injured, they were taken out of the squad for the second half of the season. Gayle, touch and go whether he'll definitely be back this year, but there's a bit of a more positive prognosis over the last few weeks, and I think he may be back in early December. So he has made the squad, as has Matt Ritchie, who's out with a shoulder problem, but again, should probably be back in a month or so. And instead, that the unlucky person who misses out really is Christy Natsu, because you look at the others, Lazar was never going to make it, Savé was never going to make it, and Roland Arons was never going to make it. And then it was sort of between Deandre Yedlin, who, as we've spoken about before on the podcast, as I've written about, there was a strong possibility he was going to leave this summer. It hasn't ended up leaving, and so Yedlin gets the nod, and instead Christy Natsu finds himself outside the squad and sort of in a bit of limbo like a few of them are.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't feel like, as you say, it doesn't feel like there was anything in there that was particularly shocking, but I just don't think there were those options. Anyway, I'm the same as you. I am, the one I'm worried about is Callum Wilson and to a lesser extent, Alan Saint-Maximin. I only say to a lesser extent because he would be less easy to sort of replace anyway. But yeah, it's those options in attack that really seem skinny. And I think I'm sure that's why Gayle has been included, that even if he's only back for a couple of weeks or a month this year, that's they would be kind of crazy not to at least have that option. So I'm sure that's why they've taken that decision. There were no surprises about people leaving or indeed coming in at the end. So fair enough. So that's what we've got. I mean, to kind of reiterate what we've been saying over the past few weeks, I think it's a good squad now. You can make the argument that this might be their best squad since coming back up, but there are still weak points and there are still areas for concern if they get injuries. You were at the under-23 game this week as well, weren't you, in which we saw some players continue their comebacks from injury, and we saw the first sighting of a new signing.
Yes, so I was at St James's on Monday for the under-23s. It's the first time I've seen the 23s play this season, because when they're playing at the training ground, due to COVID restrictions, even the media can't get in. So with them being at St James's, it was a big game really in terms of who was involved. Matty Longstaff played for the first time this season, the same with Paul Dummett, and Kieran Clark made, I think it was his third appearance this season. But Clark and Dummett played 60 minutes, which was always the plan. Matty Longstaff, just the first half again, was the plan as they start to return from injury. So it's good to see them back, which lessens a bit of the injury concern at centre-back, particularly because Newcastle have had a few issues there. Obviously, they tried to sign one during the summer, weren't able to, and so it's good to see that Dummett and Clark are back. The new signing who was on show is, there's been a lot of excitement about Rodrigo Vilca, 21-year-old Peruvian signed for, I think it's initial, about £250,000. He's very much coming as a development squad signing, but he is in theory available for the Premier League squad because he was 21, under the age of 21 at the start of January. He could be brought into the squad if necessary. I've had a lot of questions from fans saying, oh, what was he like? A lot of interest from Peru, the amount of Peruvian people who message about this, because it's huge news across there, Peruvian coming across to a Premier League club. Whether he's likely to be involved with the first team this season, I'd say that's highly unlikely at this stage. There was definitely, you can see the raw material is there. He's got a very good touch in him, good vision, but it also, a lot of work needs to be done in terms of physicality, learning the pace of the game, adaptation. That's what Newcastle have brought him in for. The initial plan was for him to be part of the development squad. He may go out on loan in January. I think unless he really excels, we're highly unlikely to see him involved in the first team in the next 12 months or so. But interesting that they have bolstered the squad in that sense, because there is quite a lot of excitement in terms of what Vilca can potentially turn into.
I'm very happy to see Paul Dummett back, I must say. I do think he's the kind of player that you really do miss when he's not in the team. I do wonder, though, I mean, and I know you mentioned this in your piece, where there is now a place for him and if there's a place for him, because Newcastle have now spent fairly substantially on Jamal Lewis over the summer. And he's young and very highly regarded and has done well so far and can offer something in attack. Paul Dummett obviously plays at left back or has played at left back. I've always thought that his best position would be at centre half, but he's not necessarily a natural fit in a four-man defence, is he?
No, he isn't. And so you'd think he's probably best suited to, if they were to go back to five at the back, and be the left centre back. He is a more defensive option at left back, though, and I think that in some big games when Newcastle maybe struggle down that left hand side, when they think they're going to need a defensive player, then that's where you can bring Dummett in, because Jamal Lewis and Alan Saint-Maximin, as we've mentioned a few times in this podcast, defensively they are lacking. They're very good going forward, but if you're against a team who has a strong right hand side, I think that you may look for Paul Dummett there. He can play in a four-man defence at centre back, but I do think he's best suited to being the left sort of centre back. So he's a sort of versatility option. I don't think he's going to be first choice by any stretch, but I agree that he's definitely someone you want in the squad, and he is sporting a sort of, I think he's got like blonde tints in his hair at the minute, I noticed the other day, so that was interesting to see. Paul Dummett coming out of his shell a little bit.
He's done that before, hasn't he? He dyed his hair white at one point, didn't he? Or grey or something?
Yeah, Silver I think he Fox. Did, yeah.
Awful. I mean, Paul Dummett's doing something like that. You expect it of Alan Pardew. I realised that the game had officially gone when he came into training one day. There was an open training session and he had white boots, you know. And he said that day, if you can't beat them, join them. And it's like, I'm sorry, that is the death of football. Never mind pay-per-view, never mind the top six leaving, whatever, bollocks. Alan Pardew wearing white boots was the sign of the apocalypse. Paul Dummett with sort of tinted hair. I don't think he's better than that. You know, he's belt and braces. He's like Greggs. He should be wearing black boots.
Yeah, I sort of quite like it, though, that he's sort of trying to be something maybe he isn't. He doesn't seem overly comfortable doing it, and yet it's, I'm trying to change my image sort of thing. I'm a little bit more of a fan of him than that. In terms of now you've mentioned some of those things, you obviously weren't here last week when Taylor had a very good rant about, both pay-per-view and Project whatever bollocks it was.
I can't remember what it's called. There's been so many...
Big picture, I think it's called.
There's been so many bloody projects.
Well,
too many projects.
There are far too many projects, particularly when they're being concocted by a cartel of six, or a cartel of two, as it seemed to be, because it seemed that some leaders even distanced themselves from it. But George, in terms of, well, let's deal with that first. Then, what was your reaction to Project Big Picture? What were your thoughts on the idea?
If I can reverse that slightly, I listened to the podcast last week, and I listened to it when I was running, and I have to say I was fueled by Taylor's anger, and that was very good. But I'm also furious, although my fury has a slightly different target, because the target of my fury is actually you. And can I explain to you why?
I mean, I thought that you were always furious at me anyway, but this seems to be a special occasion.
This is just genuine white-hot fury, right? Because I seem to remember a few weeks ago, you were in one of your like narky moods, right? And you called me up on shortening Alan Saint-Maximin's name to ASM. Am I correct?
I did, yes.
Right. Last week, you had the nerve to shorten pay-per-view to P-per-V, which is the most pointless nickname shortening ever. And is frankly, it's offensive. I mean, ASM is actually good shorthand for Alan Saint-Maximin. It's easier to say. It's quicker.
He's a person.
Yeah, but changing pay-per-view to P-per-V is utterly pointless.
I just said that incorrectly. It's meant to be PPV, and I said it incorrectly. That's just me.
Well, you said P-per-V.
Well, that's and more out of turn.
But P-per-V is not easier to say than pay-per-view. It doesn't serve any purpose whatsoever. So that was my fury. I was more angry about that than people having to spend 15 quid to actually buy that load of rubbish. But anyway, yes, the whole Project Big Picture thing, I mean, it's just sort of, if they want to go, then my very strong advice would be please go ahead and leave. We don't want you. We don't need you. And it's such a naked attempt to change the balance of power in the Premier League and throughout the whole of football, to take away competitiveness, to take away that whole idea that everybody is an equal. We know that they're not, of course, but because there are clubs that already have shitloads of money and others that don't. But the sort of the nerve of ostensibly offering money that clubs are desperate for at the moment, particularly lower league clubs, and then sort of bringing this in on the quiet where only the bigger clubs can effectively get to decide what they want, to effectively rule football, is astonishing. I was really annoyed about the pay-per-view thing as well. It strikes me that, you know, there are Newcastle fans. You wrote a great piece about this, Chris, where, you know, Newcastle fans have, those who are tied to long-term season ticket deals, have had their money taken a long time ago. There are still people paying direct debits for season tickets at the moment. They've not seen any games, didn't see games at the back end of last season. People subscribe to Sky and BT and spend a lot of money for it. And then the one other thing that has been mentioned a bit less is the fact that Newcastle took advantage of taxpayers' money over during lockdown to furlough their staff. So effectively, I mean, okay, fine. Did we pay directly to that? Well, we pay our taxes, and so we've contributed to that. And so people are being asked to pay three or four times at the moment. And I just think, you know, I'm not blaming Newcastle directly for this, because it's not, you know, they were part of that collective decision. But it sent out all the wrong messages to me at a time when we're all supposed to be in it together. Everybody is suffering, and I hated it. And the one thing I wanted to say as a positive thing about it was that it is just absolutely brilliant and astonishing. It's not really surprising when you think about the fan base, but £20,000 has been raised for the Newcastle fans food bank by people, instead of giving £14.95 to Sky to watch that game, actually donating to something which will go a long way to saving lives, improving lives at a time when it's really needed. That is, you know, what football's should be about at the minute and should be doing. So full of admiration for the people who got that together and the people that keep the food bank running on a daily basis.
I want to echo all of your comments there. The likes of Bill Corcoran and every single person who's involved in the NUSC Fans Food Bank, and every single person who donated now or has donated in the past and will donate in the future. And beyond just the Newcastle Food Bank, I've seen the amount of clubs now picking up on this and raising. I think the Burnley Fans Food Bank's raised more than £20,000 as well. Loads and loads of them are doing it. And so often football fans, we see negative headlines that they're made out as if football fans are the very worst of us. Well, this has shown that football fans can also be the very best of us. And I think that it's brilliant to have seen. And I just think £15 as a price point was ludicrous, even without the points that you've already raised and that I raised in my piece last week. But the fact that instead so much money is going towards good causes and people are shunning it, see that neither Sky Sports nor BT Sport would release their figures, which is unsurprising because I just don't. Certainly, I mean, was it West Brom against, who were they playing on Monday? Whoever that game was, I mean, why?
Burnley.
West Brom, Burnley. I mean, who's going to, if you're a neutral, you're definitely not going to pay for that. And it seems like a lot of Burnley fans certainly didn't. So I hope that the numbers were rubbish.
How's the bacon, did you say?
Well, and I wasn't, you know, I took the decision not to watch it as a journalist, someone who follows Newcastle and writes about Newcastle. I felt a bit guilty about that, but I also really didn't want to. And so I kind of went through that very old-fashioned thing of listening on the radio, which is kind of great. And I also watched it on Twitter, as it were, which is not old-fashioned at all and is slightly less great. And then I watched the highlights on Match of the Day. So it was sort of quite interesting. And I did want to talk to you a bit about that sort of whole point of the way things can be perceived and the way things sort of actually are, because you were in the stadium. Now, I was following it on Twitter, and according to Twitter, it was probably the worst game that Newcastle have played under Steve Bruce in terms of the sort of the level of sort of vitriol and sort of dismissing of the way Newcastle played, albeit that they were kind of beaten very late on in the game. And so that was the way I was sort of perceiving it. I was thinking, oh my God, this sounds terrible. I need to chat to Chris about this. And then obviously our colleague Alan Shearer was pretty sort of brutal on Match of the Day as well. But your response to it was sort of different, wasn't it? And sort of inside the stadium, it didn't feel quite as bad as was made out outside.
Yes, and I just want to preface my answer here by saying that please listen to the whole of my answer before you rant at me on social media, which I'm sure you will anyway. But it was strange because there's absolutely no doubt that Manchester United deserved to win. And I think if the game had finished 2-0, you would have said this was a comfortable win for Manchester United. Newcastle were thoroughly outplayed. That was deserved. But as you say, there was this reaction as if it was the worst performance ever. And I don't think Man United were brilliant. I don't think they were as good as some people are making out they were. I don't think Newcastle were quite as bad as some people were making out. I think that they were passive. I think they allowed Man United too much possession, too much territory, too much of the ball, and they in no way deserved anything out of the game. But if that performance was just an isolation, if that was just one game, I think you could almost write it off. But the problem is that it isn't. And this is in a wider context of the amount of times we've seen Newcastle play in this way or be almost seemingly as passive, almost allow the opposition, that, as I said before, the territory, the space, the ability to get shots away, to have all these opportunities. And the majority of the shots that Man United had, that 27 efforts, the majority of the ones they had were either straight at Carl Darlow from quite a distance or were poor, and they were poorly executed. But the issue was Newcastle just allowed them to do that, and really Man United were wasteful with them. So although Steve Bruce, some of his answers after the game I thought were a bit strange, and I don't think he responded particularly well to some of the criticism that came out, I also can see what he was saying to a small extent about Newcastle still being in the game. I don't think they were still in the game because they'd actually done anything well. I think they were still in the game because Manchester United's finishing was poor and that they didn't take control of their chances. I also don't think it was a 4-5-1 defeat. Yes, you can point to 27 shots and say, well, I had 27 shots, but actually I think that what was more concerning for me was the wider context of how Newcastle have been playing rather than just Saturday as an isolated incident.
I just find this whole thing fascinating, and it's the world we live in at the minute, and it's the era that we're going through at the moment, this very strange, sort of peculiar coronavirus football that we're watching at the minute, where suddenly the judge and jury is removed from the stadium and it goes elsewhere. And I can't sort of emphasise enough how surreal it is to be inside a stadium watching a match, because we've all kind of got used to hearing the fake crowd noises when we're watching on television. I try and turn it off when I can because I don't want that fakeness. But, you know, we're used to it. It's the same on the radio. You still hear it there as well. And being in a stadium is so surreal because there is nothing to spark off something else. So if there's a good tackle, it's silence. If there's a goal, it's silence, apart from, you know, a handful of people on the coaching staff or in the director's box cheering. You're relying on your own emotion to sort of tell you what's happening, or, you know, your own reading of the game to tell you what's happening, as opposed to bouncing off the crowd. Now, the crowd, 52,000 people, might not all have the same opinion, but they will all, or a majority of them, will be making the same sort of noises if there's a goal or a tackle or a bad foul or, you know, whatever. And so you have something to sort of relate that to. And same goes for a really bad performance. You're just like, oh, okay, they've just booed the team off, that's not good. Or they're calling for the manager's head, that's not good. And we're in this kind of void where everybody is sort of screaming on social media. I think it probably is worse than it has been in the past because, you know, it's more untethered now, because again, you can have a conversation with someone on Twitter who's saying Steve Bruce needs to be sacked, he needs to be sacked, he needs to be sacked. You could always say in return, well, okay, I understand what you're saying, but firstly, there's the, you know, the league table might tell you something else or so on and so forth. But the stadium, the final arbiter was supportive or quiet or didn't have the same response. That's gone now, and it feels like some matches are unhinged because you've got all those goals flying in. Saturday against Man United might be a case in point that if there was a crowd in there, okay, fine, Newcastle might sort of lost that game, but they might not have conceded the amount of goals they did right at the end. I was talking to a Newcastle player about this quite recently, and it's about that whole idea of concentration and alertness and adrenaline and all those things that, you know, they rely on the crowd to provide them with that. It's not about not being good professionals. It's not about being bad at that. But, you know, they're used to having that same adrenaline and that, you know, that same feeling that they have to produce because they've got an instant reaction to it. Well, there's no reaction at all now. And so everything feels skewed. It feels like score lines are skewed and results are skewed. And then the reaction we see to it afterwards is skewed.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, because certainly the fourth goal against Man United, the fourth goal that they scored, some of the Newcastle players are almost stop and running, and I just don't think that would be accepted if there was a crowd there.
No.
And it's the body language that changes. And yeah, as you say, at the minute, as much as I know that Steve Bruce generally does want fans to be back in, but I think that on the opposite side of it, you could look at it and say, well, given the way some of the performances have been, given the way they played against Brighton and Manchester United, maybe he'd be relieved in one sense that there isn't a crowd there to give him that as close and be actually in the stadium so he can hear that. But I also think that because of that, that's where we also get this disconnect where the head coach is getting annoyed about some things that are said. And I don't think that the two-way communication is really there, and that whereas if he could actually feel fans in the stadium and how they felt about the way that Newcastle are playing, and maybe that would result in more of a change as well. And I just think that it's the trend, it's the way that Newcastle are playing over a consistent period of time. They're regularly shipping a lot of shots, particularly against in theory, quote-unquote, better sides. They're no longer as defensively solid as they once were, wrote by the Sunday in the Week. For the first 2.5 years, maybe from after they got promoted, Newcastle would cede possession and territory, but they were very defensively solid, and so they would stay in the game and they didn't ship loads of chances, whereas now that defensive solidity seems to have gone, yet they still have that, they almost retreat, and now it almost feels like, well, why don't you put a few more attacking players in there, because you're not actually as defensively solid as you once were, you're still not creating chances, so you may as well have a few more attacking players on there so you can try and redress the balance a little bit.
Now, I did want to talk to you about chances, because this is actually quite amusing, isn't it? Because why don't you explain to people what you were doing for 5 hours last night? I mean, let's keep it polite.
Well, when Chelsea were playing in the Champions League and I saw about 1 minute of that game, I had it on the background, but I wasn't really watching it. I had my laptop set up and I had my tablet set up next to it, and I watched every single shot that Newcastle have conceded so far this season on Y Scout. Now, I know that some places, I think Opta says that Newcastle have conceded 86 shots. Well, Y Scout had 83 for me to be able to watch. So I've watched back all 83 chances and gone through exactly how and why such shots were able to be got off by the opposition and how strong they were, whether they were actually on top.
You've binge watched.
I have binge watched 83 shots conceded.
Is there a second series in this, do you think? Or
I really, really hope not. I really hope that this is the very end and that this is cast into the... I mean, I love every single one who listens to this podcast and who reads us, but I don't know if I love you enough to be able to do that again. So
I mean, this is incredible dedication, Chris, and very, very admirable. Really pretty hilarious as well, the fact that you've done this. And you've actually taken a note about every single one of those chances, haven't you?
When I actually finished writing the little bit last night from each of the chances, just so I could remind myself so that I could try and find some trends from it, that had more than 5,000 words. So I've had to cut that significantly, more than 5,000 words, because there was just so many chances.
So number one, shit, gave the ball away, conceded possession, got shot off. Two, gave the ball away, shot off. I mean, was it like that? Was it that sort of thing you were writing down, or what?
That sort of, yeah, essentially, basically the match situation that it was in. So this piece, again, it'll be up on The Athletic by the time this podcast comes out. And so essentially, I've tried to look for trends as to what, where the shots have come about. And this idea, because Newcastle have conceded 83 shots according to Y Scout, but the shots translation into goals conceded is not significant. It seems that they aren't actually conceding that many chances. And is that just because Carl Darlow's been very good, because he's made 28 saves? Or is there something about these chances that are being created against him? Are they not brilliant opportunities? Are teams shooting from distance? And I've tried to find these trends. And essentially, the conclusion I've come to is that at the moment, the majority of the chances Newcastle have actually conceded, the way that the moves have actually borne out, and the decisions that the opposition teams, or Spurs, or Man United, Brighton, whoever, have made, the actual chance themselves, most of them haven't been of a brilliant quality. So Darlow's made 28 saves, but for example, against Manchester United on Saturday, I think he made 14 saves, and the majority of those were from fairly tame shots. So the shots themselves at the minute aren't of concern. More of a concern is that the positions that Newcastle are seeding, and the fact that they are allowing teams to have so many efforts on goal, eventually when they come up against a team who aren't as profligate in front of goal, they will concede more chances. A team who's more ruthless, they will concede more goals, because the main issues to come from it is just primarily that word again, passive. Newcastle are passive in their pressing. They let the opposition have the ball. There's huge gaps on a regular basis between the midfield and the defence. They are conceding from set pieces as well, or they're conceding a lot of chances from set pieces, so that side of things isn't functioning brilliantly either. Sam Maximan and Lewis, when they play together on the left, obviously very exciting going forward, but Brighton, for example, exploited them down that side. Manchester United at the weekend, with a 4-1-4-1 that Newcastle played, just didn't work, because all it did was create that even bigger gap, left Isaac Hayden to cover the entire midfield by himself. John Joe Shelvey is someone I mentioned throughout. It has just been, he just is quite lazy in the way that he runs back. And that allowed Juan Mata to just basically run the game in those positions. So the trend is concerning, that Newcastle just give the opposition too much of the ball in dangerous positions. And eventually, just like as we said last season with a lot of the metrics there, eventually that will translate into Newcastle conceding more goals.
You're absolutely furious, aren't you, Chris?
I am furious. I
mean, furious with life.
Well, I thought that this would be something that would just take me not too long yesterday, but then I ended up staying up till 12:30 doing that. Then I got up this morning thinking, oh, I could just file this. And then I realised, right, I've got 83 shots, which I've written 5,000 words on. I still haven't worked out what the trend is in that. How am I going to put this into an article? Trying to get different graphics to show it. So it was not something I particularly enjoyed, but it has been fairly enlightening. It has matched what I thought from Saturday as well. Now, I know a lot of people are going to shout at me and disagree and say Newcastle were absolutely woeful on Saturday. And they were poor. I admit that they were poor, but I don't think it was, in terms of the chances that Manchester United translated into, I don't think that they were the quality of chance that a lot of people have made out that they were.
Have you seen the film The Shining?
I have, yes.
So I've just got this mental image of you, kind of your hair sticking up, sitting in front of your typewriter with it saying, all work and no play makes Chris a dull boy, just over and over and over and over and over and over again. Hi, Brucey, I'm home. Yeah, marvellous. Well, I mean, you've gone above and beyond the call of duty in your diligence there. Is there a easy solution? I mean, I guess there isn't, is there? Because otherwise they would be doing it. But do you think that the step forward is to be less passive, to be more front foot, and to kind of give that a go? Is it as straightforward as that, or does it create problems elsewhere?
It definitely creates problems elsewhere, and we go back to Rafa Benitez's short blanket, that with a mid-table, lower half, mid-table, whatever you want to call it, squad, there are always going to be deficiencies, whatever you try and do one way or the other. But I just think that we've reached a stage where Newcastle are no longer defensively disciplined, and so that being passive was seeding the pitch, but you knew that you weren't going to let loads of crosses get in the box. You weren't going to have that space between the midfield and the defence, so that you weren't going to let someone like Juan Mata get in that position. That is no longer there. And so I just think, rather than sacrifice some of the attacking players, as we've seen in recent weeks, we haven't seen Ryan Fraser start a game yet. That's partly been down to match fitness, but surely he's going to start featuring more soon. Same with Miguel Almiron. Rather than have Hendrick and Joe Linton playing right wing, which still baffles me. I don't understand why he had his best game as number 10 to move him to right wing, where he was completely ineffective and just kept giving the ball away. I think that putting more pace into the team, putting more attacking threats into the team, for a start, it'll make the opposition think that they actually think about what Newcastle can do. Alan Saint-Maximin won't then be the only threat, so you may have to leave more players back rather than commit more forward. But also, if they are going to concede chances, well, why not try and create some of their own at the other end instead? So that would be my view. And I mean, you're going down to Wolves on Sunday. You're going to Molineux, I believe, to see the game.
Yeah. So, yeah, I am.
So what would you like to see from Newcastle on Sunday?
I mean, I would just like not to see Wolves versus Newcastle United on Sunday. I would just like to go back to... I would just want to watch it on Twitter again. It's quite good fun. Well, no, I mean, I want to. I mean, Wolves are a kind of a great example. They've become a great example of a team that have come up and had a go and have a very sort of set style of play, which is good to watch, and quite a tight knit team and squad, and have found a way of playing and a way of doing it very well and very successfully. What you want from the Newcastle side of it is for there to be a reaction, and they've been okay at doing that over the last few years, and so you want that to continue. But from a kind of aesthetic point of view, you want a bit more of what we saw against Burnley as opposed to Man United. And it does feel like that there's a transitional, I mean, how many seasons can be described as transitional, but it feels like we're going through a sort of different kind of transition. Okay, fine. Newcastle have come up, they've stabilised, they've stayed up again. And this is, you know, they've obviously went through huge trauma when Benitez left and have had to, if not quite start again, they're not far off. And this is the time to try and do something else and be something else. But you want there to be that consistency. And that is the one thing that is lacking at the moment from this team. There, I mean, it's always been a club that could give paracetamol a headache, and as a team, they're like that now. You need the players to take responsibility. You need them to know what they're doing and then put it into effect. I mean, I think you're right. I think it's time to switch things around and to try and find a decent, different way of playing and then to stick with it.
If we're looking to be positive, though, and if you count a penalty shootout win as a victory, then you have a 100% record going to see Newcastle so far this season, haven't you?
Yes, that's true, but I think that does count as a draw, though, doesn't it? We've had this discussion.
Well, they're unbeaten officially.
Yes, unbeaten. And no, I am looking forward to it. I've only seen Newcastle away from home this season, but I kind of always quite look forward to it until I actually do it. And then there is that, I think I'm sort of more looking forward to the theory of it than the practice. You know, the theory of Morecambe away, the theory of Newport away, both should have been absolutely brilliant occasions, small occasions, but big noise is how I kind of referred to it. And those two kind of grounds should have been absolutely shaking. And of course they weren't, they were the opposite. Now, Newport was still very, very good, and Newcastle were poor that night, but got through, but there was still no sort of occasion. And I think I'm looking forward to Wolves because it's been a while, so I'm thinking, oh yeah, okay, that'll be good, I'll enjoy it. But I know that, sadly, I'm not trying to make this a hard luck story, because I love watching football and very lucky to be able to go to these games, but it does lack, it lacks that human touch, it lacks that human aspect, and it lacks the noise, it lacks the drama, and it lacks the occasion. So everybody is having to deal with that at the minute. Every club is having to deal with that. But Newcastle need a response. It's a tough run of games coming up now. So need hopefully to see a bit of improvement.
I would like to think that they would go to Wolves and be better than last weekend. They usually respond, but that's the problem. They need to stop having to respond. They need to just start playing.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Stop responding and start ponding.
I hope that's your intro on Sunday.
Might be. Right. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks for listening to this nonsense. This has been Pod on the Tyne. Hopefully we will have Taylor back with us very, very shortly, because I can tell you something, this is not easy. And I apologise if it hasn't met its usual high standards. Taylor, please come back. Chris, thank you very much indeed.
No, thank you very much for having me. And yes, I wish Taylor all the very best and would love to hear from him soon.
Thank you very much. We will chat to you soon. Ciao.